progressive voice of Minnesota, Brett Johnson, with you on your Tuesday afternoon, Election Day. Yeah, these types of elections during off years don't get a lot of attention, but there still are some races to be watching, both locally and nationally. At least the big one I'll be watching on the national scene is what's happening in Virginia as they are electing their House of Delegates and also State Senate. If you might remember what happened in 2017, they had a big Democratic wave, which actually led their state House of Delegates to ending up in a 50-50 tie, which had to be broken by a coin flip. And the gains the Dems made back then were actually pretty amazing when you consider how gerrymandered the state House of Delegates was back during that time. They, of course, have had court rulings which forced Virginia to redraw their districts. So that race may give us a hint in terms of where we'll be going in 2020 in terms of kind of the national mood on politics. Of course, at the local level here in Minnesota, many referendums and school levies are up for a vote. In fact, I think it's 40 of them all together throughout the state of Minnesota. And then many contentious school board elections are taking place, especially on the west side of the metro, where Minnetonka is having a big debate about whether they need to cap enrollment. And then in the eastern Carver County School District, they're having a big debate about race relations as they've been beset by problems over the past couple of years. And over on the east side in St. Paul, we'll finally end up knowing what's going to happen with trash collection. Will it end up staying citywide, or are we going to go back to the system, well, that they had before in St. Paul? We'll have a full report later in the week on what happened in all of those local elections, and Matt McNeil will, I'm sure, also be covering those on his show as well. On our program today, though, we are going to be speaking in just a second with Peter Callahan of MinPost about some of the recent pieces he's written. We're going to be talking about state budgeting, not exactly the sexiest topic, but very important to mention in case we do have a recession, because how would Minnesota do if we do end up in an economic downturn? What would our state budget look like? Would we need to raise taxes? Would we have some more draconian cuts to the budget? We'll also be talking about emergency insulin funding and how the state Senate race is shaping up in 2020. So with that said, let's go ahead and bring Peter Callahan of MinPost onto the program. Hi there, Peter. How you doing today?
Thanks for having me, Brett.
Yeah, good to have you back on the program. There's a few topics I'd like to talk with you about today. And the first one is something you recently wrote about in terms of whether the state of Minnesota is ready to weather the next recession, because we often hear about talks in the news. Are we heading to a recession? What's going to happen if we get to a recession? And the question is, are we actually ready if we do have that inevitable recession? So the first thing I want to ask you, Peter, is that a number of organizations, some private and some at the state level, I believe, including the Department of Revenue, have conducted some tests to see how we could weather a possible recession. Can you talk a little bit about some of the groups that are starting to run these tests and how they actually work?
Well, the state does its own stress test, mainly on revenue, in which they run different economic scenarios through some software and decide, make a guess as to how they will perform in different kinds of recession scenarios. But what triggered me wanting to write about this was the Pew Charitable Trust, that does a lot of work on state government, did a sort of a 50-state analysis as to how states were prepared in a various measures. They also had some warnings and some tips for how to go about getting better prepared. But generally, they found that Minnesota was in pretty good shape, better than most, because they have a large reserve fund that they have set aside, and because they stress test at least on the revenue side, and they use that to determine what level of reserve they should have.
Yeah, because looking through this and what you wrote again in your piece in MinPost, you talked about how a report by Management and Budget recommended that a budget reserve be in each state of about 4.9%, and we're pretty close to hitting that, as we're at, I believe, currently 2.075. The recommendation is $2.3 billion, which is pretty close to where we should be. And as you talked about, we are in better shape than a lot of other states. When you were doing your research, do other states not even have a budget reserve, or is it just not as high as we have? Talk about some of the comparisons to other states.
Well, it is. I mean, one thing is the what they called the rule of thumb was that you should have that as a percentage of your annual revenue. Minnesota has it as an as a percentage of its biennial revenue, which is how it budgets, so much larger for Minnesota than other states. You know, other states have had trouble refilling rainy day funds. They don't have them as hardened in, say, a state constitutional protection as Minnesota does. Minnesota also has some automatic transfers into that fund. In fact, by the end of this year, if there is excess revenue collected, which there will be, one-third of it flows automatically into the rainy day fund. So they have those sort of statutory protections that puts them in a better position. But the other thing that I found interesting was Pew went back and looked at budget cuts from the last recession and how states have refilled those budget cuts, meaning that, and they were heavily, you know, a lot in education, freezing funds for education, cuts for higher education, social services. And Pew feels that you should have rebuilt those budget levels by now, because it gives you some fat, and I know people who receive state funding don't consider it to be fat, but gives you some place to cut in the next recession. It seems counterintuitive, but if you haven't refilled those spending areas, you are starting the next recession at the bare bone and have less room to cut. So they thought it would be a good thing and would help states weather recessions by refilling those cuts from say, 2008, 2010, which Minnesota has done.
So we have largely refilled that because, for lack of a better way of putting it, because as I remember back to the last recession, and this even lasted looking at state budgets into like 2011 and 2012, we were running constant massive deficits. So the question is, have we built up those state reserves enough to possibly cover another recession? Because I remember back to those times having those constant budget crises and also making large cuts to state government. So we appear to be in better shape, correct, in terms of having those reserves. And then, as you also said, getting state government levels back up to where they were prior to the Great Recession.
I don't think they'll have a rainy day account large enough to negate the need for any other responses should there be a recession. I mean, the state spends, you know, pushing $48 billion over a two-year period. So any reduction in revenue is going to probably go deeper than that, or at least be feel the effects of that. What the Rainy Day Fund wants to do is soften the effects of cuts and perhaps negate the need for tax increases, which they tend not to want to do at the bottom of a recession. So the Rainy Day Fund, and then you also have to agree when it's a rainy day, because that's right, a political decision that's made by legislatures, is to soften the impact of that. And, you know, on the other hand, you don't want to be taxing a lot of the economy at a time just to fill up rainy day funds during other times. So that's why they come up with an idea that this would be a good, safe, relatively safe amount, and that's where that 5% comes in. But no, there will be cuts to state spending at the time of a next recession.
So another aspect you wrote about in this piece was the state and making contributions to pensions, because I didn't know this, but you talked about the fact that the legislature actually makes contribution decisions rather than having required contribution increases automatically as determined by actuaries, which makes the state budget decision, I guess for lack of a better way of putting it, kind of easier, but does not necessarily make our pension situation better than other states. Can you talk a little bit about that and kind of how that worked? Because I actually was not aware that we had that type of a decision-making when it comes to pensions, that it sounds like the legislature who gets to decide those funding levels.
Yeah, that was something that Mark Haberman, who's the executive director of the Minnesota Center for Fiscal Excellence, which is somewhat business-leaning, sort of middle kind of a Main Street business organization. So just to give you some perspective of where they come from, but their numbers are generally considered to be pretty responsible. He saw that as sort of a half-full, half-empty situation. Mm-hmm. Yes, in a recession, because the legislature doesn't have automatic transfers into pensions, they have some flexibility to maybe put less in that year or next year in order to have more revenue for this emergency that they're in. But the other problem with that is it could further underfunding of state pensions. And Minnesota is better off than a lot of states as far as pension funding, but they're not at where they need to be. So he saw that as say, helpful in the short term, mm-hmm. but has the potential to make the problem with pension funding worse in the long term.
Right. So you talked to several people writing this piece, including Mark Haveman, who's the executive director of the Minnesota Center for Fiscal Excellence, as we talked about, also the state economist, Laura Kalamakidis, and other people from Pew. Are they recommending any changes that we should be making here in Minnesota for the future in terms of setting up budget reserves and preparing for an economic downturn?
Pew's main recommendation, which gets pretty kind of nerdy, you know, down into the budgetary weeds, but they think you should stress test the spending side as well. So when a recession comes, your draw on state services actually increases. Somebody might go back to college because they're laid off and they want to get more education. Certainly social services become more in demand as unemployment grows. Pew's recommendation was that you should do a stress test where you measure how much a recession might cause increased spending pressure and be able to be prepared for that. They cite Utah as a state that they think does that very well. And the state economist said, even though that probably would not be her division, it would probably be the budget division at Management and Budget, she said that those would be good numbers for her to have and to the state to have. So that was the recommendation that Pew made that seemed to be have some reception on the part of the economist.
We're speaking with Peter Callahan. He covers state government for MinnPost. And Peter, I want to move on to another subject and briefly touch on what's been happening with insulin, because a few days ago we had kind of an unusual spat between the Senate Majority Leader Paul Gazelka and Governor Tim Walz, because at a news conference, Tim Walz was actually asked about a tweet from Paul Gazelka saying that, well, Gazelka wanted to meet with Walz and get funding. But apparently at this news conference, Walz said he received no correspondence. The first he actually heard from him was through Twitter. So, Peter, I got to ask you, outside of Donald Trump, this seems kind of unusual to have pure correspondence actually coming from Twitter, policy almost being made via tweet. This is something that we haven't really seen recently in political times. Definitely kind of odd, isn't it?
Yeah, it was interesting just from a pure political standpoint to be in that press conference room and see the governor actually nonplussed. I mean, he did not see the tweet from Gazelka. He's sort of expressing to us in real time this frustration of, what, now I need to be looking at Twitter from these people when, you know, we talk to each other all the time, and he's trying to respond to Gazelka's statement that would seem to be throwing cold water on the idea of further, you know, like conference committee or unofficial conference committees or task force or pushing discussions about bills. And he was like that angry. the governor can show emotions and show anger. But I had not seen him just so frustrated. And at one point after a reporter read the Pratt tweet that he'd been trying to meet with the governor and had sent communications to the governor and hadn't heard back, he looks over at his staff that tends to line the side of the conference room and looks and says, you know, what am I supposed to do? Are we supposed to reply via Twitter now? And it was fun for us to watch because mm-hmm. it was real time. This was not rehearsed. This was not planned. And he was expressing, I think, real frustration. The interesting thing is that the result of this was, in fact, a meeting with Pratt and Mike Howard, the House DFL lead person on this issue, the very next day. And the very next week, this week, they are all, in fact, appointing three task force members each, and may in fact be meeting this week. So it turned out well for the issue, but it was very bizarre to be watching it in real life.
So you were actually in the room at the time when he was kind of befuddled by what was happening on Twitter, which, as you're saying, kind of makes things interesting sometimes as a journalist, where you get politicians who are being a little more candid and off the cuff and not necessarily pre-rehearsed. So certainly had to be kind of entertaining in a way. But let's talk about this work group that has been set up. I know last time we talked, you were thinking maybe we'll have an agreement for sure by the end of the year. Do you think this work group is moving us in the right direction in terms of trying to finally get a compromise before the next legislative session?
Oh, Brett, I have made so many guesses on this issue, all of them, you know, to be thwarted the very next day by someone. This is a fascinating issue unless you're a type 1 diabetic or a family member of a type 1 diabetic, because it has slipped back and forth so many times. And right when it appears that particularly the Senate Republicans, who have been the sort of the sticking point on this, it seems that they are making a proposal that's going to work, and then the next day the majority leader seems to reverse course, and then it comes together again and then reverses course. It's in any other setting with any other background, I would say, yeah, this looks like they are very close. They really have agreement in principle on a couple of different aspects of it. But I can't predict. I mean, it's just been so strange the way this has flipped around.
Yeah, I'm right there with you. Yeah, I've tried making my own predictions in the past as well. It's something you really can't do at all. And as you said, it's unfortunate for people who actually are very much affected by this bill, because they're kind of out there left in limbo when they hear, oh, it looks like we're going to have a compromise, then we're not. So, yeah, it's definitely a tough issue to – yeah, go ahead.
The two big pieces seem to be there where they were disagreeing, and it was all over funding. Who pays for this? Democrats say industry pays for it. A lot of Republicans, though not all the Republicans in the legislature, say, you know what, we just continued the provider tax. This we should not be adding fees, taxes on any kind of health provider. There's plenty of money for us to find this $1 to $2.5 million amount, rather than doing a new tax, a new fee, a new bureaucracy in the state. That was the dispute. But the Eric Pratt proposal was not a fee, but it was the industry will fill orders sent to them by doctors from people who can't afford their insulin. And the industry, which already has some of these sort of charitable, if you can't afford your drug, contact us and we'll see if we can help. You see that on the commercials? Mm-hmm. Pratt was going to say, you will fill all of these orders that are sent to you by doctors. So the industry was paying the bulk of it. That was a huge piece to this. The second piece was the Democrats, Walz, Howard, saying, all right, we don't need 100% of the cost to be borne by the industry. There can be some other state contribution to this, and that's where this sort of, I need my insulin today, right now. I'm going into the pharmacy. I'm out. I don't have a prescription, or my prescription's expired, or I can't afford to pay for the prescription. The state appears to be, or the Democrats appear to be willing to have maybe even just a couple $100,000 a year from state sources pay for that little piece of it. So those two big chunks seem to be there. That's why it's so bizarre as to why they can't then come up with a deal, because the thing that had kept them apart all summer appears to be gone.
Yeah, we shall see where we end up with emergency insulin funding. Hopefully the next time we end up talking here, Peter, we'll finally have a compromise and won't be having to talk about this each time I bring you on for an interview. So we shall see eventually. And that was part one of our conversation with Peter Callahan of MinnPost. On the other side of the break, it's part two, where we'll be talking about state Senate races in Minnesota in 2020.
When you need legal assistance,
and browse through the wide variety of local Minnesota-made gift boxes. Shipping is always included in the price. There is sure to be something that will leave a lasting impression. That's YouBetchaBox.com.
AM 950, the progressive voice of Minnesota. Reminder, it is election day, and if you're planning on voting, do make sure you research the candidates, as typically in off-year elections, very low voter turnout can sometimes end up with some interesting people that probably shouldn't be in office. So if you're out there voting, do make sure you do your homework. Let's get back to our conversation with Peter Callahan of MinPost. All right, one more topic I want to touch on with you, and that is what you wrote about this race for the state Senate, because you're talking about how that's, of course, going to be highly contested here in Minnesota. And one aspect you talked about is a little bit of the partisan gamesmanship going on between the DFL and the Republican Party, with the number of senators who won very close races during their last election cycle back in 2016. You highlighted Matt Little. He's a Democrat for Lakeville, and basically how he's kind of been pushed out of basically having his name on any sort of bill. And we've also seen some gamesmanship from Paul Anderson, who won a very close Senate race. He, of course, is from Plymouth. So talk a little bit about this aspect of Little and Anderson facing very tough elections here in 2020 and some of the gamesmanship we've been seeing from both the DFL and the Republicans to try to minimize their chances of winning re-election.
It's easier for Anderson because he is in the majority. In fact, you could make a very strong case that his very tight victory in that race 3 years ago delivered the majority to Paul Gazelka, because that was the one seat. And they'd been expecting to win Little's Lakeville seat, and they lose it somehow. So Anderson really delivered for them and was rewarded. He was given a committee chairmanship as a freshman, the Higher Education Committee. He's been in the middle of a lot of legislation. But again, he doesn't come to this thing as a rookie. He was Tim Pawlenty's deputy chief of staff. He's been congressional aide. He knows politics and he knows legislation. So it was likely that he would have gotten a large position or an important position either way. But that's a tough race, and Little's is a tough race. So what if they flip those two? What if the R's take back Little's seat and the D's take back Anderson's seat? Well, they're still where they started then. The R's still are in the majority. So even though those two get most of the attention, they both have to go look at some other seats. The D's have to look at some other seats to pick up, and the R's have to look at some other seats to defend. But the surprising thing to me in looking at them district by district is how few battlegrounds there are. I mean, the people who give money, the people who run campaigns can give you 10, 12 seats that might be battlegrounds. But really, when you get down to it, a year from now, it's going to be 3 or 4 or 5 Senate seats that are really going to be determining who has the majority. And the majority this next time is important because redistricting follows.
Right.
If the Republicans lose the Senate and they don't regain the House, we know they're not going to have the governorship, then you've got Democrats completely in control of redistricting, which Republicans would really like to avoid.
Yeah, that would certainly be a nightmare for them. And we can probably expect a lot of national money coming in, because I even remember reading on MinPost how these national groups for both the Republicans and Democrats, at least nationwide, have been able to pin down a number of these legislative races around the country, where I think the Republican side said they were basically able to target 50 legislative races that could effectively decide who controls the U.S. House of Representatives. So, of course, there's major stakes at the national level as well, and I'm sure we're going to be expecting a lot of national money to come into some of these local races. I'm sure Little's and Anderson's race are among them. Are you seeing any others where we could potentially see some national money come in to these state legislative races?
Generally, it goes, sometimes it flows to organizations within the state that make those calls. Sometimes it flows to the caucus campaign committees, and that they can use them, use that money as they decide or they need it. But there are, I think you will also start seeing some money directly, but there are limits to how much you can give to a campaign, to a legislator's campaign. There are no limits to how much you can give to an independent expenditure committee that can be spending money independent of the candidate, going into races with direct mail, hit pieces, maybe cable ads, maybe a lot of Facebook ads. So that's where I think most of it will flow. It will flow to independent expenditure committees
or it will be spent that way by some of these national organizations to try to affect it. So it's trackable, mm-hmm. but it's not going directly to, say, Paul Anderson's campaign.
All right, Peter, one more question for you. In terms of each side looking for pickups coming up in 2020 in the state Senate, pretty obvious on the Democratic side, they're going to be targeting a lot of these suburban seats that went to two House districts in terms of DFL pickups and now are represented by a Republican senator. But how about on the GOP side? Because as we alluded to earlier, there's not a lot of pickup opportunities in greater Minnesota. I mean, there's a couple seats in northern Minnesota with Tom Bach and David Tomasoni, but they're largely entrenched in their districts. And, of course, as you brought up, the GOP's in the majority. So are they looking at really many pickup opportunities? I know you mentioned Matt Little, or are they primarily going to be taking their resources and playing defense and making sure that they are protecting the seats that they picked up back in 2016?
Right. You know, that seems logical that you would just defend and hold on to the seats that you have since you're starting the election with a majority. Generally, they think that's kind of a bad idea to only do that. They want to be on offense. They want to pressure the DFL, and they want to have someone prepared to get a victory in the event that you get another surprise like Matt Little winning a district that was being counted for the Republicans. Yet you're right. The range, northern Minnesota, they would really like to have someone trying to paint the Democrats as anti-pipeline, anti-mining. Unfortunately, the incumbents all have very good records, the DFL incumbents, as far as those issues are concerned. Mm-hmm. So they would like to go there. Really, the DFL needs to look in districts that have a city in them of some size. That's kind of where they win. So you go up to, they would like to look at St. Cloud, because there's a very close race in St. Cloud 3 years ago. They really want to look in Rochester, where there's two Republican senators. That's where they want to look. And the D's, or the R's, want to look in, I would call it, the second-rung suburbs, because mm-hmm. those first-rung that they got killed in last time in the House races, they don't seem to have much hope there. They're going to go out a little further in the Twin Cities. They want to go to Iron Range, and they want to go to northern Minnesota.
We'll have to see where it goes, where a lot of this money starts flowing as we head into the 2020 election cycle. That's Peter Callahan. He covers state government for MinnPost. And, Peter, really want to thank you for taking some time and joining us on the program today.
Okay, it's been fun. Thank you.
And as always, you can find more of Peter Callahan's writings over at MinnPost, as he does a great job covering state politics. We'll have more on the way, but first it's time for the news from Public News Service.
Welcome to the Public News Service Daily Newscast for Tuesday, November 5th, 2019. I'm Dan Hyman. The White House is dealing with fallout of a first batch of full testimony transcripts released by the congressional committees considering impeachment. According to CNN, a former senior advisor to Secretary of State Mike Pompeo directly contradicted public statements by Pompeo about the removal of an ambassador to Ukraine. Meanwhile, a federal appeals court has rejected an appeal by Trump to block prosecutors from getting the president's tax returns. An attorney for the White House says they plan to take the case to the U.S. Supreme Court, the last remaining avenue of appeal. The president also now faces two civil defamation suits, both brought by women who say he lied about them when denying rape allegations. In all, more than two dozen women have accused Trump of sexual misconduct. Between 2018 and 2019, nearly 25,000 people in North Carolina reached out to a crisis center for help related to sexual assault, and state lawmakers there have voted unanimously to close legal loopholes related to consent and sexual assault.
The loopholes made North Carolina one of the few states in the country where cases of rape that initially began with consent or that involved voluntary use of alcohol or drugs could not be prosecuted. Investigative reporter for Carolina Public Press, Kate Martin, analyzed 4.5 years of state court data.
We concluded that fewer than 1 in 4 people charged with sexual assault are eventually convicted. And of those people who are not convicted, the defense might be that the act started with consent.
According to the court data, among the approximately 1,000 people charged with sexual assault within that 4.5-year time frame, just 2% were convicted. Governor Roy Cooper is expected to sign the bill. For Public News Service, I'm Nadia Ramlagan.
Off-year elections today may give some indication of where the nation is headed ahead of 2020. Democrats in Virginia are hoping to build on wins in the last two cycles in the state general assembly. Two governor's races in normally Republican states look unusually close. Mississippi Attorney General Jim Hood has a decent shot at becoming the state's first Democratic governor in 16 years. The incumbent is term limited, but President Trump has campaigned for his opponent, Lieutenant Governor Tate Reeves, which suggests the White House expects a close race. Trump has also traveled to Kentucky to help that state's embattled governor, Matt Bevin. He faces a serious challenge from State Attorney General Andy Beshear. Microsoft Japan says an experiment in giving workers more time off has been a huge success. Over the summer, workers there put in just 4 days a week, but got their normal 5-day paychecks. The company says productivity rose 40% in spite, or maybe because, of all the 3-day weekends. I'm Dan Hyman for Public News Service, member and listener supported, and online at publicnewsservice.org.
Hi, everybody. This is Paul Metza inviting you to listen to a great new episode on the Wall of Power Radio Hour featuring Native American musician and activist Keith Sekola. Keith and I grew up on the Iron Range together. We're going to talk about our backgrounds and everything Keith's been doing, including playing with Neil Young, U2, and more. The Wall of Power Radio Hour airs every Saturday at 6 p.m. on AM 950, the progressive voice of Minnesota.
With all the convenient big box stores that sell appliances, why do so many Minnesotans choose Warner Stellion? Check online to learn that Warner Stellion is a Minnesota family-owned business for over 60 years. Warner Stellion sells more brands than anyone else, and our passionate specialists are committed to impressing you so much that you'll refer us to everyone you know. That's our mission here at Warner Stellion. Ask around. Check us out online. And when it's your time to buy appliances, join over 300,000 Minnesota homeowners and choose the specialists, Warner Stellion.
I'm Candy Broffel, publisher of the Twin Cities edition of Natural Awakenings magazine and host of Green Tea Conversations, a new show for people who are on a journey to take responsibility for their health and play a more active role in their family's well-being. Join me every Sunday at 10 a.m. as I interview local experts who share the latest in natural holistic approaches in a fun and informative way. So grab a cup of tea and join the conversation as we awaken to natural health. Visit us at naturaltwincities.com.
With your AM 950 weather, this is Eric Nelson. Tonight, mostly clear skies with a low around 29. Tomorrow, sunny with a high near 52 and a low around 36. Saturday, sunny with a high of 55 and a low around 37. Sunday, with a high of 44 and a low of 27.
Your Eat Local Minnesota's restaurant of the week is the Downtowner Woodfire Grill. The Downtowner is the perfect choice for breakfast, lunch, and dinner 7 days a week. Experience their cozy fireside dining alongside their delicious food and extensive wine list. Check out the full menu at downtownerwoodfire.com.
And we're back on AM 950, the progressive voice of Minnesota. Open phone lines the rest of the hour, 952-946-6205, 952-946-6205. Of course, it is election day, and as I was doing my, well, very limited research on this off-year election, I found out I only have literally one race to vote in. Just one. It's for the Hopkins School Board. That is the only thing that actually appears on my election ballot. And it got me thinking, why do we need to continue having off-year elections? You almost have to kind of wonder, can you get to democracy overkill where you're having an election every single November? Because for me, in my case, one election. It's kind of tough to get motivated just to vote for one office, especially if it's school board, where it's extremely tough to actually learn anything about the candidates. In fact, as I was trying to figure out who I'm going to vote for in the Hopkins School Board election before the show, I could only find a link to one of the candidates who even had a campaign website available to even do any research.
Thankfully, I actually kind of do know who I'm going to vote for, thanks to actually Matt McNeil, who also happens to be in the Hopkins School District. He actually knows a little bit about some of the candidates to help me kind of give an idea about who I might and might not vote for. But Eric, I don't even know if you've looked at your ballot on your side, but that strikes me as being not even worth actually having an election if you're only going to have one thing on the ballot. To me, we need to set up some kind of system where maybe you only have elections every 2 years. These off-year elections, just you have a very low voter turnout, and then you have elections where you can't even find anything about the candidates. Have you looked at your ballot, or are you
even
paying it?
Yeah, I have no candidates on my ballot, but I do have a referendum for not a school levy, but a change in funding.
Yeah. And see, that's the thing as well. That's a very important thing to vote for as school board. I'm not saying school board is an unimportant thing to vote for, but if it's the only thing on the ballot, you're typically not going to get people to vote for these things or vote against them. To me, I think we need to have a set system where you either can have an election during a presidential year or in what's called a midterm election, where you actually will get people showing up to the polls and actually giving their input. Because in your case, that seems like an even tougher thing to vote for if it's only a school referendum. You're not actually even voting for anyone in particular, and that can give, I think, an undue amount of power to people who actually are fired up about the issue. So
I think that gives an appropriate amount of power.
You think appropriate? Okay.
Because I think that it's best to give it directly to, you know, the taxpayers who are going to pay for this funding if they want to contribute more towards improving the schools.
Okay.
They're going to be the ones directly affected by the outcome, so it makes sense that they would be able to choose.
I just have a tough time feeling like you have a mandate, though, if you only have 5 or 8% of the population that even shows up to vote in that specific election, or 5 to 8% of eligible voters that even choose to give their input. But you're saying, well,
I think it's kind of self-selecting, where the people who are the most engaged, people who are most enthusiastic for or against it, are the ones most inclined to vote for it.
Mm-hmm. So you're actually okay with having these off-year elections?
I am, and it's like if the voter turnout is not super high, I think that's fine as long as the people who it impacts directly are still eligible to vote.
I just, yeah, have an issue that people don't pay attention, because this is kind of the more cynical side of me is saying is that, well, if you don't have someone up for running for a higher office, whether that's the presidency or the Senate or the House of Representatives or the governor, people generally aren't going to show up and vote, and well, they might find out, well, my property taxes went out and it went up and I didn't mean them to. Now, of course, I get your point in saying, well,
I mean,
that's kind of your
happen,
fault.
It's going to happen either way. And would you rather have any say in the matter, or would you rather just have
I think absolutely we should have say, but you should only be having these votes during what are more traditional elections, which would be during a presidential year or a midterm year. I think absolutely, yeah, you should be voting for those. But when you hold those in odd years, like in this cycle, 2017 or 2019 or coming up in 2021, it doesn't strike me that you're getting good governance when you're only having 5 to 8% of the population. But maybe you're making a good point, though, in saying that, well, if you really are that fired up about the issue and you show up to vote, well, then you should actually have more
influence.
Those
are going to be the people who are voting are the people who are fired up about it. So I don't know.
Yeah.
It's kind of self-selecting, I think.
Yeah, I think you're right. It just strikes me as tough to get motivated when you're only voting for school board, or you're only, in your case, voting for a school referendum. 952-946-6205, 952-946-6205, because I actually broke this down. What's up for election in 2016, 17, 18, 19, and into 2020? What you can actually vote for generally across the country. Obviously, in presidential years, you can vote for a whole lot of stuff. You get to vote for the president. You also get to vote for, well, 34 of the 100 Senate seats are up for election. You have all 435 House seats up. In presidential years, that would be 2016 and 2020. You can also vote for the governor in 11 states. And of course, you have other state and local offices. 2017, well, not so much the case. There were basically no federal elections whatsoever. And at least at the gubernatorial level, only two governorships were up in 2017. And that'll be the same thing in 2021. That would be in New Jersey and Virginia. The midterm elections, that would be 2018. You actually do get 33 senators that face re-election. You have, of course, all 435 House seats up. You also have 36 governor elections and other state and local offices, while here in 2019, most people will not be able to vote for any federal office. Only three states hold gubernatorial elections. That's Kentucky, Louisiana, and Mississippi. And, of course, you still have other state and local offices. So I would just think, why not move these elections that are typically held in off years, like 2017, 2019, or coming up in 2021, to those even-numbered years where you are going to have a higher voter turnout and, well, actually an electorate that will probably give their opinion? Again, I get what you're saying, Eric. I don't think you're necessarily making this argument that people should have kind of an undue say if they are actually the ones that show up to vote. But I would think if you actually held like these school board or these school referendums or city council elections or school board elections, if you put these through in even years, like in a 2016, 2018, or 2020, maybe you actually would get people kind of interested in doing their research. Because at least when I go out and vote in those even numbered years, I look at my sample ballot and I do generally go down ballot and at least do some minimal research in terms of who I'm going to vote for. Typically, that involves going to campaign websites. That's mostly when you're voting for things like judgeships or maybe city council when you don't get a whole lot of information. But yeah, I think it's tough to get people motivated when you don't really have anything at the top of the ticket that's really not going to affect them too much in terms of what they're actually paying attention to. 952-946-6205, 952-946-6205. I want to continue on this point and also talk about some other elections we should be watching tonight, because even though, as I said, there's not a lot of, well, really top-level races that are out there here in this 2019 cycle, there are a few races that I think you should pay attention to tonight that could give us some indications in terms of what will happen in 2020. That's on the way next here on the 4 o'clock show with Brett and Eric.
I am attorney Rachel Schroman of Schroman Law in St. Paul, and I am passionate about providing legal services in the areas of estate planning, probate, and elder law. My clients receive the attention and compassion they deserve, with their peace of mind being my top priority. Enjoy the comfort of knowing that you have planned for the worst so you can confidently continue living at your best. Visit SchromanLaw.com. That's SchromenLaw.com.
Crooner's Lounge and Supper Club is delighted to offer its spacious facilities for your private function. From weddings, retirement parties, business dinners, or any special occasion, Crooner's combines a dedicated full-service special events team, an award-winning chef, and a beautiful lakeside ambiance to make your event a resounding success. Visit croonersloungemn.com to learn more about their private dining options, or call 763-571-9020 to get a quote for your next event today.
What kind of a jackass would let an animal pick their insurance? Did you really think a lizard could save you money on car insurance? Would you let a duck pick your health policy? Insurance can be a zoo, but this is ridiculous. What you really need is an insurance agent that isn't looking out for the insurance companies. You need Cheryl at Array, an independent agent with 30 years experience looking for the best rate possible. Quit monkeying around and call 763-504-3067. That's 763-504-3067 for Cheryl at Array, representing you, not the insurance companies.
This is Chad, owner of AM950. Our station has worked with Barbara from WYSIWYG Web Design for years on everything from logo to print design, and especially for developing our website. She does great work and is great to work with, listening to what our goals and design ideas were while offering new, innovative ideas to create the website we are proud of today. Barbara made sure she understood our station, our goals, and our mission before she started working on our site, and made suggestions to help control the cost. Plus, she's friendly, which set us at ease. I recommend Barbara at WYSIWYG Web Design because I know she will deliver an attractive, professional website within the budget you have. She is a local independent business that specializes in helping other local businesses achieve their website and design goals. She can work with nearly any budget and create anything from simple sites to robust custom functionality. To find out more about the company AM950 Trust, go to WYSIWYGWebDesign.com. Spelled out just like it sounds, WYSIWYGWebDesign.com.
Hi, it's Tom Hartman. You know, Continental Diamond is special for a lot of reasons. The owners are Jimmy and Helene Pessis, a husband and wife team who had a dream to open their own store more than 30 years ago. They've built a business that is the gold standard. The readers of Minnesota Bride Magazine have named Continental Diamond the best jeweler for the last 7 years. Why? Amazing, friendly, no-pressure customer service, a selection of fine diamonds and design jewelry unlike anywhere else, and the fresh-baked chocolate chip cookies are pretty great, too. Continental Diamond in St. Louis Park and at ContinentalDiamond.com.
We're back on the final segment of the 4 o'clock repartee. We got Brett and Eric with you on your Tuesday afternoon. Reminder, Robert Pilot going to be filling in for us coming up tomorrow on the program. Lots of great guests. And, of course, you can also hear him during Native Roots Radio presents I'm Awake every Saturday from 1 until 3 o'clock. So before we get back into election news, do got to pass along a couple of fun pieces of news. You remember back when Donald Trump had his rally here in Minneapolis and how there was controversy about the fact that he wasn't paying his bills for all of the security that was necessary. Well, after Bernie Sanders held his rally the other day at the University of Minnesota over the weekend, guess what? He's already paid his bill in full. Now, granted, of course, this is a little more trollish saying he has much less security than what's required out of the President of the United States, but there you go. So often you hear people like Bernie Sanders, Elizabeth Warren being criticized for saying, how are you going to pay for all these programs? Well, at least they go ahead and actually do pay for their campaign rallies. One other piece of news I wanted to pass along to you. Also, do you remember how the Minnesota Republican Party said Trump was going to be the only person you could vote for on your primary ballot coming up in March of 2020. Well, the chair of the Minnesota Republican Party, Jennifer Carnahan, has sort of reversed course. Sort of being the key part. You still will not be able to vote directly for Joe Walsh, Mark Sanford, or Bill Weld, but they have at least amended their earlier idea, and they now actually will allow you to write in a candidate outside of Donald Trump. So you at least do have two options now. But yeah.
Unlimited options.
Unlimited options. So you could write down Eric Nelson for president on the Republican Party or Brett Johnson. So that's why I said it's sort of a walk back of their earlier policy, but not really very much. They still are not going to include any of the three other. I would still term them as major candidates, being that Joe Walsh is a former congressman, Mark Sanford is a former governor, Bill Weld also a former governor, so they're not just a couple of randos who are running for the Republican nomination. They actually do have some experience at higher office, yet they are not going to be allowed on the ballot, but woohoo! You can at least actually write someone in if you get a Republican ballot coming up in 2020. So before we wrap up the show today, we do I do want to pass along some other races to watch for tonight. So yesterday I was talking about how this Virginia race, in terms of who's going to control the state legislature, would be kind of fascinating to watch, because in 2017, under heavily gerrymandered districts, the Democratic Party in Virginia was actually able to work to a 50-50 tie in the House of Delegates. In fact, one of the elections that actually was going to determine control literally finished in a tie, and they actually had to go to a coin flip, which was won by the Republicans. Now, what they've done since is that those gerrymandered districts were actually thrown out, so they had to redraw them, so they're now much more fair. So that could really give us an indication in terms of where things are going in 2020, because Virginia is very much one of those purple states, although I would argue it's probably more of a bluish purple. The other one I'm going to be keeping an eye on is Kentucky, because this race really interests me. You have Matt Bevin, who is the current Republican incumbent in Kentucky, who, if you remember, was elected in 2015 on the promise that they were no longer going to have the Obama Medicare expansion. Well, it turns out that didn't go over so well with the electorate in Kentucky. He's also had many battles with the teachers union down there. And his opponent is a Democrat by the name of Andy Beshear. Now, what I'm watching with the Andy Beshear strategy is that he's kind of taken a strategy that we've seen a lot of Democrats use here in at least the 2019-20 cycle, and even going back to 2018, where he's purposely not really talking about Donald Trump at all. He's more talking about positively what he would like to accomplish if he gets the governor's mansion. And that goes very much in contrast to Matt Bevin, again, the Republican incumbent in Kentucky, who very much has embraced the Trump administration So that could give us kind of an indication tonight as well whether this strategy that Beshear, the Democrat, is using will actually pay off and work, being that he's basically had a campaign where he's pretty much avoided talking about Donald Trump at all. So at least a couple of races to watch tonight. And of course, here locally in Minnesota, I'm still interested in what's going to happen with the trash in St. Paul, whether they're going to continue having their citywide contract or if they're going to go back to the old system where everyone gets to decide who is their trash collector. So hopefully we'll have some results to you on tomorrow's program. And again, Robert Pilot will be filling in during the 4 o'clock hour. I'm back with a live show coming up on Thursday. Thanks for listening.